because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, Wisconsin Eye's summary of this week in the Capitol. Well, sometimes, J.R., there's little news in the summer, but man, we are covering it. It's lots of it everywhere. Let's start with, okay, the provision in the current state budget. Mm-hmm. Said County Executive Abley in Milwaukee County, yep. You could name a commissioner, what's the term?
Commissioner, shorthand turnaround commissioner, oversee basically a program, opportunity program, something like that.
Yes.
But basically what it would
opportunity
do is,
schools.
What it would do is you would take over between 1 and 3 schools this year and up to 5 in years after that if they're failing schools in Milwaukee, basically pull them out of MPS and give them a new approach, if you will, okay. Under the direction of this person appointed by the county executive.
But now we are leading our rewind with this because MPS says we're not going to play in this, mm-hmm. Right? Well, first of all, let's back it up. Abley named
Demon Means,
the MPS
graduate.
Bill. Yeah, MPS graduate. And his wife teaches, I think, in MPS as the commissioner. But now MPS recently said, no, we're not going to join the initiative, correct?
They gave a very weak, if you will, response. They weren't really playing as aggressively as Republicans at least would like them. I guess you can put it that way.
Okay. Then Mr. Means resigned, surprising all of us. Mm-hmm. But now it heats up. And the reason we're leading Rewind is what Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald said. Unfortunately, I think the only hammer is, listen, if you're not going to participate, if you're going to try to work around the law, then you're probably going to see some significant reduction in revenue for MPS schools. And Representative Dale Coinga, a CPA on Joint Finance, tweeted, Milwaukee left political leadership chews up and spits out anyone trying to change the status quo. Before I give it over to you, JR, I just want people to know, last year's mm-hmm. aid to MPS totaled $644.9 million. Now, by comparison, if you raise our sales tax by a penny, it brings in $1 billion. So MPS is getting almost two-thirds equal to one of our mm-hmm. 5 cents on the sales tax. Okay, your turn.
All right, so what's interesting is that MPS, let's go back to the early 1990s when choice was first approved. And the idea behind choice was that there are failing schools in Milwaukee, and if we do choice, you'll force Milwaukee MPS to compete yep. and to retain students.
And you will empower parents. Go ahead.
Okay. The compete part has fallen on the wayside. Now it's all about choice to get them out of these failing schools. Republicans, largely suburban Republicans, also Caucasian suburban Republicans, have had enough of MPS leadership and not seeing improvements, where you have a predominantly African-American school district chafing at suburban, again, Caucasian Republicans saying, this is how you should do things. There are all kinds of dynamics to this issue. The bottom line, though, is Republicans are on the show right now. Barring a complete wipeout this fall, they still should have both houses of legislature after November. They will be in the driver's seat of what happens to MPS going forward. Now, the question becomes, what will it be? Fitzgerald raised the issue of funding, about cutting that. I don't know if that's the way they're going to go in the end.
How can you really do that? Go ahead.
Well, you could just say, look, if you don't want to play, you're not going to get as much money. You know, you could do that. But then if you cut funding under the formula, do you allow a huge property tax increase to Milwaukee homeowners? That could be a problem. So we're in a kind of a stage with Republicans of right now they're angry because they thought they put forward a modest turnaround program where we're not going to just take over MPS in general, you know, overall, but we're going to start taking these schools that are failing, that are not getting better, and trying to pick them off one by one.
It's also important to note who put that idea forward and, you know, who put it together?
Dale Coinga,
member of
Finance.
Darling.
Co-chair
of Finance. Excuse me.
So now, Republicans are angry. This is the first stage, if you will. They're kind of like, we're had enough. The next stage is, well, what are you going to do about it? Now, choice has grown to what? I think the cap now on enrollment is, there's no cap on enrollment, but it's 300% of poverty level for income. They've raised it quite a bit.
The weighted average is $7,300 per student yeah. for choice students.
So do you try and go through the choice program to add more money to it, make the vouchers more attractive, something to encourage more kids to leave MPS to go through vouchers? That's one option. The bigger thing, though, might be governance of MPS. What happens next? Now, again, Republicans used to at one point argue local control for everything, but mm-hmm. their now standard seems to be local control unless you're not controlling it the way we want you to. And that's kind of become a standard they've used, if you will, in a number of things the last few years. MPS not performing the way they want it to, they're going to step in. So what do? We've been around for discussions of break up MPS into several districts. It was a Tommy Thompson idea.
Governor Thompson recommended that. It went nowhere.
Governor Doyle at one point proposed a mayoral takeover of Milwaukee schools as part of a federal program trying to attract more money. That didn't get off the ground. So what happens next? I mean, it is clear that Republicans have tired of MPS leadership and want something different, but they're a locally elected board. How do you do that? That's kind of the rub of what do you do next with that. If leadership is your issue, how do you affect leadership in Milwaukee?
So I understand Senator Fitzgerald saying, you know, it could be about the money. But if you cut the $644.9 million that MPS is now getting, that just seems really punitive on a bunch of largely poor minority kids, because it's now a district dominated by minorities.
Well, you also remember you have this cap of how much you spend per student. And the less state aid you get, the more property taxes you raise. So you're also punishing homeowners, unless they do something with the formula that I haven't figured out yet. You'd be punishing homeowners in Milwaukee. That's another kind of whammy to go. So, but where do they go? And where does this anger take them? This disappointment take them? That's the question that will take a while to answer. But they will probably have a proposal in the next budget. Now, Governor Walker has kind of asked about this a little bit. I don't think he wants to take over MPS. I don't think the idea that he wants to be in charge of MPS. So does he get on board?
Right.
If he's not on board, what lawmakers want to do is a heavier lift. You know, so that's got to be another issue. And we're still in the very early stage of this.
Yes.
So I can't say for sure what it's going to look like come February, governor's budget comes out, and come May, when we hope finance is done with the budget.
Let's back it up to November 9, the day after the general elections. We'll see, you know, what the control numbers are in both the Senate and the Assembly.
Yeah.
But it's a major development how angry suburban Republicans are at MPS. New subject. So in 2013, we passed a law saying if you're going to perform an abortion, you have to have admitting privileges at a local hospital. Mm-hmm. I don't know what local means, whether it was 20 miles or something.
30-some miles, I think
30, okay. We also said then before abortion, you have to have a ultrasound. And, well, the Supreme Court on Monday struck down the Texas law on the admitting procedures, and on Tuesday refused to hear an appeal of our law. So that killed it. But still in place is the ultrasound.
Yes. Standard. So what's going to be interesting now is, I mean, it was no surprise when the Supreme Court didn't take our case because it mirrored the Texas law quite a bit. And actually, if you read through the concurring opinion from Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she mentioned the Wisconsin.
She did.
Both the Federal Appeals Court decision that struck down or upheld a ruling striking down the Wisconsin law and some other provisions there, it was no surprise that they didn't take that case. The question now becomes, okay, what's next? Remember, Wisconsin is one of several states that passed a ban on abortion for 20 weeks. That was a big proposal this past last spring.
Now it's law.
Will abortion rights advocates now look at this as a green light, start challenging more and more state restrictions? We kind of went through this, if you go through the history, so Roe v. Wade's 1973, Casey decision 1992, and Casey opened the door to more state restrictions. And so last 20, almost 5 years, abortion rights opponents have been spending their time chipping away at the state level. Will this decision open the door to supporters saying, okay, we're going to start fighting back more? Because one thing holding some of these folks back has been, if we go to the courts and get an adverse decision, the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, that could be the death knell for whatever we want to do. Now you've got a 5-3 ruling that this was one step too far. You have Hillary Clinton in a very strong position right now in the polls, at least. If she wins the presidency and she appoints that ninth member of the Supreme Court, you would assume, and it's a dangerous thing in politics, but if you're a Bush Run supporter, you have a good audience, if you will, on the U.S. Supreme Court to challenge more of these laws. So that's kind of another thing in play of the presidential race. Will Republicans who are unhappy with Donald Trump say, well, I got to go because of the Supreme Court? Or will, you know, Clinton folks be heartened by this? Like, we got another opportunity to kind of strengthen these laws. That's another subtext, if you will.
So we don't know the plan B of our right to life lawmakers. And let's point out that Senate President Mary Lozick, who was key in passing these laws, she's not going to be in the next session because she's
several lawmakers, though, so they're not going to be dissuaded by this or go back at it. Remember, Andre Jacques, for example, proposed that law or bill to ban research on fetal tissue from abortions. Now, that could get his own caucus. Right. So the likelihood of getting through the full legislature right now is kind of dicey. But they're not going to be deterred from trying. The question becomes, what's the line going to be with the courts going forward?
Right. Okay. Weeks earlier, Governor Walker has said, again, no new increase in the gas tax, no increase in the license plate renewal fee. So help me understand, JR, why he wrote Transportation Secretary Gottlieb a letter formally saying, let's read a couple points. 90% of our most traveled roads are in fair and better condition. Raising gas tax or our license plate renewal fees is not an option. We must, however, have in your next budget proposal an increase in local road aids and state highway maintenance. Let's minimize spending on Southeast Wisconsin mega projects. I want to ask you what that means. Mm-hmm. And finally, hold bonding to a reasonable level, keeping in mind that we're now bonding at $850 million in the current two-year budget. Why did Governor Walker have to formally tell his WISDOT secretary in a letter what he had told reporters like 3 weeks earlier?
Oh, he's trying to get the upper hand a little bit in this discussion because you've got Robin Voss, for example, Jim Steinke, both top leaders in the assembly, and others really agitating for some kind of revenue upper the next budget. So if you break it down into several pieces, one, you have the, all right, Mark, I want the budget, September 15th. Usually what happens with DOT is you get like half of it in September and then the whole enchilada after the election. Remember back in 2014, 11 days, 10 days after the election, $750 million in new taxes and fees that he proposed.
Yes.
And another $500 million in transfers from the general fund to kind of keep things as is. Now,
all of which the governor and the GOP lawmakers walked away from.
Now, Marco didn't go rogue back in 2014 and do this.
Did not.
He was teeing up the conversation in which Walker went and said, okay, we're going to propose borrowing $1.3 billion, not raise a gas tax or do a fee increase, but that'll cover these things. If you want your roads done, here's what you got to do. Lawmakers said, no, no, no. They pared it back. So fast forward to now. He's trying to, one, get this out there and say, okay, guys, you want to advocate for a gas tax. Look, we can still do A, B, and C without raising taxes. So now you go advocate for a gas tax hike to do D, E, and F.
Okay, but we cannot do D, E, and F in Southeast Wisconsin, the mega projects. Mm-hmm. This means a north-south on the Zoo Freeway, we don't even know when that's going to be done.
Well, if you look at the current biennium, almost all the money, almost all the money is going just toward the zoo as it is for Southeast Mega. Now, remember, these are definitions. So if you can get it off of a mega project list and make it just a major highway, you know, you could probably find some money for it. But the mega projects, almost all the money goes to the zoo right now. So there's not really any work being done. I mean, north-south isn't really active right now. There isn't a lot of trucks out there breaking up concrete and expanding it right now. East-west, 94, they've done design work, but it's not active right now. It's all about the zoo. So you could, in theory, say, well, we're just going to wait two more years on the north, south, east, west, 43, and just kind of push them off in the future.
But, JR, when do we see a list of major highway projects statewide that will be delayed, and how long they're going to be delayed, pushed out 3, 4, and 5 years as a result of a no-tax increase with that budget?
The question, will that be in that document? Will they show what they're going to do? Will lawmakers then agitate, well, we got to raise taxes? And how do you, if you're a Republican, this is kind of one of the rubs I can't get past. How do Republicans go out there and say, we want a gas tax increase when they're an anti-tax increase party? Now, leadership is making the argument of it is more conservative to pay for your roads than is a borrow for them. But for the rank and file, I can't find rank and file members saying, yeah, we're really going to run on a gas tax hike this fall. And oh, by the way, most of the conversation coming from the assembly leadership. It's not from the Senate leadership because they're looking at a different caucus that's saying we're not as enthusiastic about it, if you will. Now, I've talked to members of finance. A majority of Republican members of finance would do a gas tax hike, but that's just finance. Again, you have to go through rank and file, get through both houses, get one done.
Yeah, I understand that. But we've been taping candidate interviews. In fact, we're up to 53. And Democrats are more willing to raise a gas tax, but I have interviewed a few Republicans who are saying maybe it's not such a bad idea, which goes back to Speaker Voss kind of upping the ante and saying, I have a major disagreement with Governor Walker on this issue, which, am I wrong, foretells the possibility of an assembly budget that maybe does raise a gas tax, thereby daring the Senate and governor to act? To kill it?
That becomes a question. Will you have a showdown about this? Because the governor has the most powerful veto in the country, so he can wipe it out. Will you force that issue, number one? Number two, can you get through both houses? And three, can you override the veto? That's a big, you know, lift, a big mountain to climb.
It is.
So, but, you know, they're really going to make the argument of, and this is the subtext a little bit, Republicans and Senate legislators are going, we're going to be here for a while. We're not sure who Governor Walker is. Now, Walker has said he might seek re-election. He said he's going to now make a decision about a third term after the budget is done. There are still those who don't think he's going to be around for a third term or question if he's really committed to one. They're going, we're going to be here for a while. And oh, by the way, borrowing more money doesn't solve the long-term crisis. We have a long-term issue in transportation. It is not going away. The gas tax, the source of revenue, is not going to be more reliable in 5, 10, 15 years. So what do? Build fewer roads, borrow more money, find a miles driven tax, move to a different model. What do you do? There's only a good conversation going on right now. One thing Walker did say in this letter, though, was let's find money in savings. Savings from design procedures. How much can you find there? I don't know. There's a big pot of money in that. Direct money to safety and maintenance. Direct money to locals. I mean, he's moving money from we're not doing any big, giant mega projects back to the local level and take care of local roads and kind of keep things trucking along.
The biggest puzzle I think they face in the next budget is the transportation budget.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, new subject. Democrats this week opened a new campaign theme when they made public a Legislative Fiscal Bureau report summarizing who's going to benefit from the manufacturing and ag credit. And what intrigues me is the best estimate of the manufacturing and ag, which is a tax credit. It's going to be $209 million in tax year 2017. And of that, according to the Fiscal Bureau report, 88% will go to people with adjusted gross incomes of more than $500,000. Mm-hmm. And three-fourths of that, $209 million, will go to taxpayers with adjusted gross incomes of more than $1 million. So responding to this, Gordon Hintz, Democrat on the Joint Finance, said, "We knew Governor Walker's tax cut for the wealthy was regressive and expensive, but these latest numbers are mind-boggling. Apparently, he thinks it is just fine that a mere 11 individuals will receive over $21 million in tax breaks this year without being required to create a single job." Do you think this is a pretty live campaign issue for Democrats?
Yes. And to back up a little bit, I mean, WFC, for example, came to the Manufacturing and Credits defense this week saying this has been a big boon, help us create jobs. That part, the argument of who it's benefiting, if it's worthwhile, that's not going to get settled anytime soon. What Democrats are trying to do now, though, is create a link between stuff like this and cuts to schools. So you saw this week, for example, Jennifer Schilling saying they cut schools to create a tax break for millionaires. And that's one thing they have to do to make this effective message is create a link. You know, talking about tax breaks, that's kind of old conversation. We've heard that time and time again. But creating a direct result or a link, if you will, that may be a more effective message for voters. Now the question is, can they find an effective message on this and have it in a 30-second radio ad or in a mailer that this fall hits home and people go, okay, I get it now, this is a problem. That's kind of up to them to figure out how to do that.
Well, I'm wondering, why was Hintz the message bearer here? He's a member of finance?
Former guy in city finance, local government. He's kind of like one of the budget wonks, if you will, on the Committee for Democrats. This has been one of his pet projects working on this. So, you know, and they're trying to drive that message of there's a link. And we've talked before. Democrats think they have an effective kind of like just menagerie of things to bring up, you know. GAB.
Open government, transparency.
You've got to create links to everyday people that go, okay, this is affecting my life and how. That's the challenge for them.
I agree. Okay, one person we said goodbye to this week is Kevin Kennedy. It's July 1. He no longer works in state government. He's retired. It's interesting, though. He was GAB Director and General Counsel from 2008 to 2016. GAB is now out of business. Elections Board Director, Legal Counsel, 1979 to 2008. 375 elections. It's pretty intriguing. So I interviewed him this week, and I said, Mr. Kennedy, you're ending your career after 37 years and 3 months working with elections. What did you think of the Supreme Court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruling that basically said it is legal for campaigns and third-party groups to coordinate? Here's what he said.
The decision that was written was such an embarrassment. It was intellectually void. I'm talking about the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision that had absolutely no reasoning to it. It was basically taking platitudes, citing news sources. It was an embarrassment to lawyers in the state of Wisconsin to have our Supreme Court and those justices that wrote the opinion write something to that effect.
Should Justice Gableman and Prosser have recused themselves from that?
That's difficult to say. I think that's a legal question that needs to be looked at. It certainly needed to be examined. I think the Caperton decision suggests...
Out of West Virginia.
Out of West Virginia suggests that ought to be weighed. And I think the quality of what you saw in the opinion reflects exactly what the influence that kind of activity was.
Were you surprised at how critical Kevin was of that Supreme Court ruling, calling it platitudes, news reports? And also, when I followed up, should Justices Gebelin and Prosser have gotten off, have recused themselves, a legal term? He basically said yes. You surprised?
Yes. No, not really. Cut part because Gerald Nickel, the former chair,
in said benediction?
Said very similar things before. I mean, you can tell that the members of the board were not happy with that Supreme Court decision and have been critical of it before, so that doesn't surprise me in that way. But the shackles kind of off for Kennedy. He's been, now Republicans would dispute this, but he's tried his best the last 30 years to kind of play it down the middle. Some would argue at times that he's actually had a very poor sense of politics, that if they'd been smarter about things politically, they would have gotten less criticism. But that said, your 60-second clip lit up conservative social media this week. They were very unhappy with Kevin's comments.
So what? Kevin's no longer a player.
Yes, but they feel like it's a sign of that how the board had been biased against them, if you will, that he was, you know, had an axe to grind. But, you know, same time, that's, somebody who now is free of government work. By the way, speaking of that, I show up
First
for the
Amendment rights.
Oral arguments yesterday in federal court. There's Kevin Kennedy, first day of retirement, in a Hawaiian shirt watching oral arguments on about a dozen GOP-passed election laws.
Now, I've got to ask you a question that I really don't know the answer because I've been kind of traveling around the state. Did the U.S. Supreme Court, they adjourned, did they take any action on the appeal to hear? They did
John
not.
Doe, no.
Does that mean they still could accept it?
Carries over. As far as I know, it carries over. They're still taking briefs last time I checked on that one.
Okay, thanks. So that has not been resolved, whether the U.S. Supreme Court is going to weigh
don't
in on
believe
that.
So.
Okay. Finally, Jared, not finally, next subject. JR, I'm such a wonk. I wanted to know how many Wisconsin cars are affected, how many Wisconsin Volkswagen cars were affected by the federal huge controversy. Mm-hmm. So the answer, according to Attorney General Brad Schimmel, 11,571 VW owners or renters in the state are entitled to settlements. Schimmel said in order for the market to function properly, Wisconsin consumers need to be given the truth and have the ability to make informed decisions about the products they buy. Well, that's kind of an apple pie is good and let's have some cold beer statement. But that is 3 in 1,000 Wisconsin cars. Now, you have another dimension. We're going to get a fund out of this?
So, as often happens with settlements, we're part of it. I think it's like $11 million come back to the state. Now, the question is, what's DOJ going to do with it? Last we had checked, they didn't have an answer. But it often happens, like with drug settlements, you know, drug pricing problems. We get a chunk of money that they can use for consumer protection or to fund other things. So, a little bit of a boost as well to DOJ's bottom line.
Okay, that's interesting. Now, you mentioned you were closing arguments here in the federal courthouse on the photo ID law. Well, what's a fair summary? The judge pretty much said, I don't know what to do.
Well, you got to break it in a couple. There are like a dozen laws that are being challenged. They run the gamut from restrictions on early voting to voter ID. Peterson, you know, kind of raised the prospect of, I don't think anybody's made a persuasive argument either way about the impact on turnout from voter ID. Like he said in one of his quotes was, when it rains, people don't turn out to vote sometimes. You know, you don't know. You can't extrapolate out just this one piece, if you will. He's not persuaded that, A, there's been a big drop, or, B, that because we had a big boost in April turnout, that means that voter ID is fine. So there's that piece of it. So, but the one thing you have the most problem with, though, is this appeal process. If you don't have an ID and you don't have and you get a free one, but you don't have the documentation to get it, what do you do? And he called that problematic. He said the racial disparity is appalling. The question is, what's the fix? And he asked both sides this yesterday, what do I do if we have to have a patch, if you will, get through this election? Because now what he said is that whatever he does is going to be appealed to the Seventh Circuit, pretty much a done deal. But not going to impact the April, or also the August primary, but for November. How do we get through November with this problematic patch? Now, it's a very small number of people. But as he said, A, they're legitimate voters, denied their right to vote because they can't get the ID. B, the people who even are successful sometimes may have had their rights infringed because of the process that they go through to get it. So what do you do for those folks? And even if it's a small number, there has to be a patch. How he's going to craft that patch, though, I have no idea.
So this sounds to me, and I wasn't in the courtroom and you were, but it sounds to me like a judge is asking for help. How can I tweak this law, right?
So I don't want to predict he's definitely going to do it, but the thing he found most problematic was that appeal process. So how do you address it? I'm not sure what he's going to do with that.
Okay. Now, he has said he's certainly not going to come out with anything to mess up the August 9th primary.
I hope to have a decision by end of July.
End of July, but it won't affect
the
August.
Did not expect
9th.
It to, no.
Okay, and you think his ruling will rewrite a little bit of the rules for November 8th?
He seemed troubled by that. I hate to predict what judges are going to do.
Yeah, it's very dangerous.
But he seemed very troubled by that one. That was when he had the most problem with it, if you will.
Okay. Okay, final topic. You got to, since there's no West Politics stock report, you quoted Tim Cullen as saying, I'd raise my hand and run for governor if
maybe
no one else. Explain that. And here's why. On Election Day of 2018, he'll be 74 years old.
Well,
former state senator.
Let's look at our current crop of presidential candidates. Bernie Sanders was 72.
Okay.
You know, Hillary Clinton's upper 60s. So, I mean, they're not young pups themselves. But that said, it is an interesting point. But Cullen comes from the less partisan wings, if you will, of both parties. He liked to work with people. He served in Tommy Thompson's administration back in the mid to late 80s. So this is a guy who has a little bit more bipartisan credentials. A couple of things. One, I've been asking around who's going to run for Democrats. And, you know, there's some names out there, but nobody really stepped forward. And so heard Cullen's name, asked about it, said, yeah, I'm thinking about it. I'm a long way from making a decision. The other rumor had been, well, he could probably self-finance. He said, no, I can't. You know, that's not really my wheelhouse. The question, though, is, well, who are Dems going to have in 2018? Kathleen Beinhout is talking openly about, you know, about it. I've heard other people mention Dana Walks from Eau Claire.
Jennifer Schilling. You've just named three Dems from Western Wisconsin.
Yes. Now, here's the thing. Dems don't need somebody from Madison, Milwaukee to run, by the way. They need someone from outstate to communicate those voters. Cullen, there is that age thing. There are other things. He's not a progressive. Like, the current base is left of where Tim Cullen is. Now he's not a good Democrat, but they're left of where he is. Can he appeal to that base, which turns out in primaries, to win? There are all kinds of hurdles to get over, but it kind of shows you a little bit about Dems are looking for somebody strong right now. They're not sure who it is. And if Walker does run, he knows the field is not settled for them, that there's not really clear challenger for him, that he could be in good shape. Now, the other thing is the White House. Every midterm election is a reaction, it seems like, to the last one. If Hillary Clinton wins, Republicans will be in good shape in 2018. If Donald Trump wins, it should be a good year for Democrats in 2018. So there are lots of unknowns, if you will, that let November settle a little bit, and we'll have a good idea what's going to happen after that.
Well, also, Thomas Nelson, the county executive, he got talked into running for Ribble's congressional seat. If he doesn't win, his name's going to be dropped for governor.
Even if he wins, how do you win a congressional seat in November and turn around 6 months later and say, oh, by the way, I'm running for governor? That's very difficult to do. And oh, by the way, on top of that, he now has the stench of Washington, D.C., even if it's only been 6 months, attached to him because he's a city those are all kinds of dynamics that were considered for him before he decided to run for Congress. Yeah, there is not a clear contender for Democrats right now.
The stench of Washington. You're saying that because it's been like centuries since.
It's just the place is dysfunctional. Everybody says it's dysfunctional, and voters aren't enamored with it. Look at the polls right now of Hillary Clinton. She's very unpopular. She is an establishment person. Donald Trump's unpopular because Donald Trump says things that make him unpopular, but people don't like Washington. That would be a difficult thing for anybody to run for governor right now as a creature of Washington.
Okay. You're in your morning report, you talked about changing some delegates to the GOP state convention or national convention.
Half a dozen swapped out.
Is that a big deal?
Well, it depends. I mean, like Jim Steinke was an alternate, all right? He made clear, I'm not going because of Donald Trump. The others are trying to reach to find out, why are you not going? What's the issue? And, you know, there is still a sense that people aren't really enthused about Trump in Wisconsin, which is what you're seeing in polls. You see all these, like, GOP enthusiasm is down. Southeast Wisconsin is a problem for Trump. You know, you're seeing signs of it. So maybe this is a sign, but until I talk to all of them, we're not going. I can't tell for sure.
But you reported that Mike Grebe's not going.
He's not going.
He's not going?
He's not coming back yet. Rebecca Clayfish is going to convention, but as a delegate. She's going to be there for 3 days, they said, and come back for official events. She also is chair of the GOP Lieutenant Governors Association, House of Defense out there, but she can't be delegate now because of scheduling. Okay. She's been replaced by Scott Fitzgerald, who's been saying, get on the Trump train.
Yep.
It's better for us down tickets. So, you know, it's something interesting to watch. And it's also interesting to watch because of the never Trump factor. Will there be a dumb Trump effort in Cleveland? I don't get the impression from the Rules Committee set up it's going to be very successful, but it could be a very entertaining convention in Cleveland in a few weeks.
Really will. I asked our national committee man, Steve King, whether he was on the phone when that 1,000 people on a conference call on dump Trump, and he said, I'm on the Rules Committee. I was not on that phone call. Great. The news continues. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Thank you. That's Rewind for this week.